service. Having obtained what information I wanted concerning streets and numbers, I wrote two letters, one to my grandmother, the other to Dr. Flint. I reminded him how he, a gray-headed man, had treated a helpless child who had been placed in his power and what years of misery he had brought upon her. To my grandmother, I expressed a wish to have my children sent to me at the North, where I could teach them to respect themselves and set them a virtuous example, which a slave mother was not allowed to do at the South. I asked her to direct her answer to a certain street in Boston, as I did not live in New York, though I went there sometimes. I dated these letters ahead to allow for the time it would take to carry them and sent a memorandum of the date to the messenger. When my friend came for the letters, I said, "God bless and reward you, Peter, for this disinterested kindness. Pray be careful. If you are detected, both you and I will have to suffer dreadfully. I have not a relative who would dare to do it for me." He replied, "You may trust to me, Linda. I don't forget that your father was my best friend, and I will be a friend to his children so long as God lets me live." It was necessary to tell my grandmother what I had done, in order that she might be ready for the letter and prepared to hear what Dr. Flint might say about my being at the North. She was sadly troubled. She felt sure mischief would come of it. I also told my plan to Aunt Nancy in order that she might report to us what was said at Dr. Flint's house. I whispered it to her through a crack, and she whispered back, "I hope it will succeed. I shan't mind being a slave all my life if only I can see you and the children free." I had directed that my letters should be put into the New York Post Office on the 20th of the month. On the evening of the 24th, my aunt came in to say that Dr. Flint and his wife had been talking in a low voice about a letter he had received, and that when he went to his office, he promised to bring it when he came to tea. So I concluded I should hear my letter read the next morning. I told my grandmother Dr. Flint would be sure to come and asked her to have him sit near a certain door and leave it open that I might hear what he said. The next morning, I took my station within sound of that door and remained motionless as a statue. It was not long before I heard the gate slam and the well-known footsteps enter the house. He seated himself in the chair that was placed for him and said, "Well, Martha, I've brought you a letter from Linda. She has sent me a letter also. I know exactly where to find her, but I don't choose to go to Boston for her. I had rather she would come back of her own accord in a respectable manner. Her Uncle Philip is the best person to go for her. With him, she would feel perfectly free to act. I am willing to pay his expenses going and returning. She shall be sold to her friends. Her children are free, at least I suppose they are, and when you obtain her freedom, you'll make a happy family. I suppose, Martha, you have no objection to my reading to you the letter Linda has written to you." He broke the seal, and I heard him read it. The old villain. He had suppressed the letter I wrote to Grandmother and prepared a substitute of his own, the purport of which was as follows. "Dear Grandmother, I have long wanted to write to you, but the disgraceful manner in which I left you and my children made me ashamed to do it. If you knew how much I have suffered since I ran away, you would pity and forgive me. I have purchased freedom at a dear rate. If any arrangement could be made for me to return to the South without being a slave, I would gladly come. If not, I beg of you to send my children to the North. I cannot live any longer without them. Let me know in time, and I will meet them in New York or Philadelphia, whichever place best suits my uncle's convenience. Write as soon as possible to your unhappy daughter. Linda." "It is very much as I expected it would be," said the old hypocrite, rising to go. "You see, the foolish girl has repented of her rashness and wants to return. We must help her to do it, Martha. Talk with Philip about it. If he will go for her, she will trust to him and come back. I should like an answer tomorrow. Good morning, Martha." As he stepped out on the piazza, he stumbled over my little girl. "Ah, Ellen, is that you?" he said in his most gracious manner. "I didn't see you. How do you do?" "Pretty well, sir," she replied. "I heard you tell Grandmother that my mother is coming home. I want to see her." "Yes, Ellen, I am going to bring her home very soon," rejoined he, "and you shall see her as much as you like, you little curly-headed nigger." This was as good as comedy to me, who had heard it all. But grandmother was frightened and distressed because the doctor wanted my uncle to go for me. The next evening, Dr. Flint called to talk the matter over. My uncle told him that from what he had heard of Massachusetts, he judged he should be mobbed if he went there after a runaway slave. "All stuff and nonsense, Philip," replied the doctor. "Do you suppose I want you to kick up a row in Boston? The business can all be done quietly. Linda writes that she wants to come back. You are her relative, and she would trust you. The case would be different if I went. She might object to coming with me, and the damn abolitionists, if they knew I was her master, would not believe me if I told them she had begged to go back. They would get up a row, and I should not like to see Linda dragged through the streets like a common Negro. She has been very ungrateful to me for all my kindness, but I forgive her and want to act the part of a friend towards her. I have no wish to hold her as my slave. Her friends can buy her as soon as she arrives here." Finding that his arguments failed to convince my uncle, the doctor let the cat out of the bag by saying that he had written to the mayor of Boston to ascertain whether there was a person of my description at the street and number from which my letter was dated. He had omitted this date in the letter he had made up to read to my grandmother. If I had dated from New York, the old man would probably have made another journey to that city. But even in that dark region, where knowledge is so carefully excluded from the slave, I had heard enough about Massachusetts to come to the conclusion that slaveholders did not consider it a comfortable place to go in search of a runaway. That was before the Fugitive Slave Law was passed, before Massachusetts had consented to become a nigger hunter for the South. My grandmother, who had become skittish by seeing her family always in danger, came to me with a very distressed countenance and said, "What will you do if the mayor of Boston sends him word that you haven't been there? And he will suspect the letter was a trick, and maybe he'll find out something about it, and we shall all get into trouble. Oh, Linda, I wish you had never sent the letters." "Don't worry yourself, Grandmother," said I. "The mayor of Boston won't trouble himself to hunt niggers for Dr. Flint. The letters will do good in the end. I shall get out of this dark hole some time or other." "I hope you will, child," replied the good, patient old friend. "You have been here a long time. Almost 5 years. But whenever you do go, it will break your old grandmother's heart. I should be expecting every day to hear that you were brought back in irons and put in jail. God help you, poor child. Let us be thankful that some time or other we shall go where the wicked cease from troubling and the weary are at rest." My heart responded, "Amen." The fact that Dr. Flint had written to the mayor of Boston convinced me that he believed my letter to be genuine, and of course that he had no suspicion of my being anywhere in the vicinity. It was a great object to keep up this delusion, for it made me and my friends feel less anxious, and it would be very convenient whenever there was a chance to escape. I resolved, therefore, to continue to write letters from the North from time to time. 2 or 3 weeks passed, and as no news came from the mayor of Boston, Grandmother began to listen to my entreaty to be allowed to leave my cell sometimes and exercise my limbs to prevent my becoming a cripple. I was allowed to slip down into the small storeroom early in the morning and remain there a little while. The room was all filled up with barrels, except a small open space under my trap door. This faced the door, the upper part of which was of glass, and purposely left uncurtained, that the curious might look in. The air of this place was close, but it was so much better than the atmosphere of my cell that I dreaded to return. I came down as soon as it was light, and remained till 8 o'clock, when people began to be about, and there was danger that someone might come onto the piazza. I had tried various applications to bring warmth and feeling into my limbs, but without avail. They were so numb and stiff that it was a painful effort to move. And had my enemies come upon me during the first mornings, I tried to exercise them a little in the small unoccupied space of the storeroom. It would have been impossible for me to have escaped. 26. Important era in my brother's life. I missed the company and kind attentions of my brother William, who had gone to Washington with his master, Mr. Sands. We received several letters from him, written without any allusion to me, but expressed in such a manner that I knew he did not forget me. I disguised my hand and wrote to him in the same manner. It was a long session, and when it closed, William wrote to inform us that Mr. Sands was going to the north, to be gone some time, and that he was to accompany him. I knew that his master had promised to give him his freedom, but no time had been specified. Would William trust to a slave's chances? I remembered how we used to talk together, in our young days, about obtaining our freedom, and I thought it very doubtful whether he would come back to us. Grandmother received a letter from Mr. Sands, saying that William had proved a most faithful servant, and he would also say a valued friend, that no mother had ever trained a better boy. He said he had traveled through the northern states and Canada, and though the abolitionists had tried to decoy him away, they had never succeeded. He ended by saying they should be at home shortly. We expected letters from William, describing the novelties of his journey, but none came. In time, it was reported that Mr. Sands would return late in the autumn, accompanied by a bride. Still, no letters from William. I felt almost sure I should never see him again on southern soil. But had he no word of comfort to send to his friends at home, to the poor captive in her dungeon? My thoughts wandered through the dark past and over the uncertain future. Alone in my cell, where no eye but God's could see me, I wept bitter tears. How earnestly I prayed to him to restore me to my children and enable me to be a useful woman and a good mother. At last the day arrived for the return of the travelers. Grandmother had made loving preparations to welcome her absent boy back to the old hearthstone. When the dinner table was laid, William's place occupied its old place. The stagecoach went by empty. My grandmother waited dinner. She thought perhaps he was necessarily detained by his master. In my prison, I listened anxiously, expecting every moment to hear my dear brother's voice and step. In the course of the afternoon, a lad was sent by Mr. Sands to tell grandmother that William did not return with him, that the abolitionists had decoyed him away. But he begged her not to feel troubled about it, for he felt confident she would see William in a few days. As soon as he had time to reflect, he would come back, for he could never expect to be so well off at the North as he had been with him. If you had seen the tears and heard the sobs, you would have thought the messenger had brought tidings of death instead of freedom. Poor old grandmother felt that she should never see her darling boy again. And I was selfish. I thought more of what I had lost than of what my brother had gained. A new anxiety began to trouble me. Mr. Sands had expended a good deal of money and would naturally feel irritated by the loss he had incurred. I greatly feared this might injure the prospects of my children, who are now becoming valuable property. I longed to have their emancipation made certain, the more so because their master and father was now married. I was too familiar with slavery not to know that promises made to slaves, though with kind intentions and sincere at the time, depend upon many contingencies for their fulfillment. Much as I wished William to be free, the step he had taken made me sad and anxious. The following Sabbath was calm and clear, so beautiful that it seemed like a Sabbath in the eternal world. My grandmother brought the children out on the piazza that I might hear their voices. She thought it would comfort me in my despondency, and it did. They chatted merrily, as only children can. Benny said, "Grandmother, do you think Uncle Will is gone for good? Won't he ever come back again? Maybe he'll find Mother. If he does, won't she be glad to see him? Why don't you and Uncle Philip and all of us go and live where Mother is? I should like it. Wouldn't you, Ellen?" "Yes, I should like it," replied Ellen. "But how could we find her? Do you know the place, Grandmother? I don't remember how Mother looked. Do you, Benny?" Benny was just beginning to describe me when they were interrupted by an old slave woman, a near neighbor named Aggie. This poor creature had witnessed the sale of her children and seen them carried off to parts unknown, without any hopes of ever hearing from them again. She saw that my grandmother had been weeping, and she said in a sympathizing tone, "What's the matter, Aunt Marthy?" "Oh, Aggie," she replied, "it seems as if I shouldn't have any of my children or grandchildren left to hand me a drink when I'm dying and lay my old body in the ground. My boy didn't come back with Mr. Sands. He stayed at the North." Poor old Aggie clapped her hands for joy. "Is that what you's crying for?" she exclaimed. "Get down on your knees and bless the Lord. I don't know where my poor cheering is, and I never expect to know. You don't know where poor Linda's gone to, but you do know where her brother is. He's in Free Parts, and that's the right place. Don't murmur at the Lord's doings, but get down on your knees and thank him for his goodness." My selfishness was rebuked by what poor Aggie said. She rejoiced over the escape of one who was merely her fellow bondman, while his own sister was only thinking what his good fortune might cost her children. I knelt and prayed God to forgive me, and I thanked him from my heart that one of my family was saved from the grasp of slavery. It was not long before we received a letter from William. He wrote that Mr. Sands had always treated him kindly and that he had tried to do his duty to him faithfully. But ever since he was a boy, he had longed to be free, and he had already gone through enough to convince him he had better not lose the chance that offered. He concluded by saying, "Don't worry about me, dear grandmother. I shall think of you always, and it will spur me on to work hard and try to do right. When I have earned enough money to give you a home, perhaps you will come to the North, and we can all live happy together." Mr. Sands told my Uncle Philip the particulars about William's leaving him. He said, "I trusted him as if he were my own brother, and treated him as kindly. The abolitionists talked to him in several places, but I had no idea they could tempt him. However, I don't blame William. He's young and inconsiderate, and those northern rascals decoyed him. I must confess the scamp was very bold about it. I met him coming down the steps of the Astor House with his trunk on his shoulder, and I asked him where he was going. He said he was going to change his old trunk. I told him it was rather shabby and asked if he didn't need some money. He said no, thanked me, and went off. He did not return so soon as I expected, but I waited patiently. At last I went to see if our trunks were packed, ready for our journey. I found them locked, and a sealed note on the table informed me where I could find the keys. The fellow even tried to be religious. He wrote that he hoped God would always bless me and reward me for my kindness, that he was not unwilling to serve me, but he wanted to be a free man, and that if I thought he did wrong, he hoped I would forgive him. I intended to give him his freedom in 5 years. He might have trusted me. He has shown himself ungrateful, but I shall not go for him or send for him. I feel confident that he will soon return to me." I afterwards heard an account of the affair from William himself. He had not been urged away by abolitionists. He needed no information they could give him about slavery to stimulate his desire for freedom. He looked at his hands and remembered that they were once in irons. What security had he that they would not be so again? Mr. Sands was kind to him, but he might indefinitely postpone the promise he had made to give him his freedom. He might come under pecuniary embarrassments and his property be seized by creditors, or he might die without making any arrangements in his favor. He had too often known such accidents to happen to slaves who had kind masters, and he wisely resolved to make sure of the present opportunity to own himself. He was scrupulous about taking any money from his master on false pretenses, so he sold his best clothes to pay for his passage to Boston. The slaveholders pronounced him a base, ungrateful wretch for thus requiting his master's indulgence. What would they have done under similar circumstances? When Dr. Flint's family heard that William had deserted Mr. Sands, they chuckled greatly over the news. Mrs. Flint made her usual manifestations of Christian feeling by saying, "I'm glad of it. I hope he'll never get him again. I like to see people paid back in their own coin. I reckon Linda's children will have to pay for it. I should be glad to see them in the speculators' hands again, for I'm tired of seeing those little niggers march about the streets." 27. New Destination for the Children. Mrs. Flint proclaimed her intention of informing Mrs. Sands, who was the father of my children. She likewise proposed to tell her what an artful devil I was, that I had made a great deal of trouble in her family, that when Mr. Sands was at the North, she didn't doubt I had followed him in disguise and persuaded William to run away. She had some reason to entertain such an idea, for I had written from the North from time to time, and I dated my letters from various places. Many of them fell into Dr. Flint's hands, as I expected they would, and he must have come to the conclusion that I traveled about a good deal. He kept a close watch over my children, thinking they would eventually lead to my detection. A new and unexpected trial was in store for me. One day, when Mr. Sands and his wife were walking in the street, they met Benny. The lady took a fancy to him and exclaimed, "What a pretty little Negro! Whom does he belong to?" Benny did not hear the answer, but he came home very indignant with the stranger lady because she had called him a Negro. A few days afterwards, Mr. Sands called on my grandmother and told her he wanted her to take the children to his house. He said he had informed his wife of his relation to them and told her they were motherless, and she wanted to see them. When he had gone, my grandmother came and asked what I would do. The question seemed a mockery. What could I do? They were Mr. Sands' slaves, and their mother was a slave whom he had represented to be dead. Perhaps he thought I was. I was too much pained and puzzled to come to any decision, and the children were carried without my knowledge. Mrs. Sands had a sister from Illinois staying with her. This lady, who had no children of her own, was so much pleased with Ellen that she offered to adopt her and bring her up as she would a daughter. Mrs. Sands wanted to take Benjamin. When Grandmother reported this to me, I was tried almost beyond endurance. Was this all I was to gain by what I had suffered for the sake of having my children free? True, the prospect seemed fair, but I knew too well how lightly slaveholders held such parental relations. If pecuniary troubles should come, or if the new wife required more money than could conveniently be spared, my children might be thought of as a convenient means of raising funds. I had no trust in thee, O slavery. Never should I know peace till my children were emancipated with all due formalities of law. I was too proud to ask Mr. Sands to do anything for my own benefit, but I could bring myself to become a supplicant for my children. I resolved to remind him of the promise he had made me, and to throw myself upon his honor for the performance of it. I persuaded my grandmother to go to him and tell him I was not dead, and that I earnestly entreated him to keep the promise he had made me, that I had heard of the recent proposals concerning my children and did not feel easy to accept them, that he had promised to emancipate them, and it was time for him to redeem his pledge. I knew there was some risk in thus betraying that I was in the vicinity. But what will not a mother do for her children? He received the message with surprise and said, "The children are free. I have never intended to claim them as slaves. Linda may decide their fate. In my opinion, they had better be sent to the North. I don't think they're quite safe here. Dr. Flint boasts that they are still in his power. He says they were his daughter's property, and as she was not of age when they were sold, the contract is not legally binding." So then, after all I had endured for their sakes, my poor children were between two fires, between my old master and their new master, and I was powerless. There was no protecting arm of the law for me to invoke. Mr. Sands proposed that Ellen should go, for the present, to some of his relatives who had removed to Brooklyn, Long Island. It was promised that she should be well taken care of and sent to school. I consented to it as the best arrangement I could make for her. My grandmother, of course, negotiated it all, and Mrs. Sands knew of no other person in the transaction. She proposed that they should take Ellen with them to Washington and keep her till they had a good chance of sending her with friends to Brooklyn. She had an infant daughter. I had had a glimpse of it as the nurse passed with it in her arms. It was not a pleasant thought to me that the bondwoman's child should tend her freeborn sister. But there was no alternative. Ellen was made ready for the journey. Oh, how it tried my heart to send her away, so young, alone, among strangers, without a mother's love to shelter her from the storms of life, almost without memory of a mother. I doubted whether she and Benny would have for me the natural affection that children feel for a parent. I thought to myself that I might perhaps never see my daughter again. And I had a great desire that she should look upon me before she went, that she might take my image with her in her memory. It seemed to me cruel to have her brought to my dungeon. It was sorrow enough for her young heart to know that her mother was a victim of slavery, without seeing the wretched hiding place to which it had driven her. I begged permission to pass the last night in one of the open chambers with my little girl. They thought I was crazy to think of trusting such a young child with my perilous secret. I told them I had watched her character and felt sure she would not betray me, that I was determined to have an interview, and if they would not facilitate it, I would take my own way to obtain it. They remonstrated against the rashness of such a proceeding, but finding they could not change my purpose, they yielded. I slipped through the trapdoor into the storeroom, and my uncle kept watch at the gate while I passed into the piazza and went upstairs to the room I used to occupy. It was more than 5 years since I had seen it, and how the memories crowded on me. There I had taken shelter when my mistress drove me from her house. There came my old tyrant to mock, insult, and curse me. There my children were first laid in my arms. There I had watched over them each day with a deeper and sadder love. There I had knelt to God in anguish of heart to forgive the wrong I had done. How vividly it all came back. And after this long, gloomy interval, I stood there such a wreck. In the midst of these meditations, I heard footsteps on the stairs. The door opened, and my Uncle Philip came in, leading Ellen by the hand. I put my arms round her and said, "Ellen, my dear child, I'm your mother." She drew back a little and looked at me. Then, with sweet confidence, she laid her cheek against mine, and I folded her to the heart that had been so long desolated. She was the first to speak. Raising her head, she said inquiringly, "You really are my mother?" I told her I really was, that during all the long time she had not seen me, I had loved her most tenderly, and that now she was going away, I wanted to see her and talk with her, that she might remember me. With a sob in her voice, she said, "I'm glad you've come to see me, but why didn't you ever come before? Benny and I have wanted so much to see you. He remembers you, and sometimes he tells me about you. Why didn't you come home when Dr. Flint went to bring you?" I answered, "I couldn't come before, dear. But now that I'm with you, tell me whether you'd like to go away." "I don't know," said she, crying. "Grandmother says I ought not to cry, that I'm going to a good place where I can learn to read and write, and that by and by I can write her a letter. But I shan't have Benny or Grandmother or Uncle Philip or anybody to love me. Can't you go with me? Oh, do go, dear mother." I told her I couldn't go now, but sometime I would come to her, and then she and Benny and I would live together and have happy times. She wanted to run and bring Benny to see me now. I told her he was going to the north before long with Uncle Philip, and then I would come to see him before he went away. I asked if she would like to have me stay all night and sleep with her. "Oh, yes," she replied. Then, turning to her uncle, she said pleadingly, "May I stay, please, uncle? She is my own mother." He laid his hand on her head and said solemnly, "Ellen, this is the secret you have promised grandmother never to tell. If you ever speak of it to anybody, they will never let you see your grandmother again, and your mother can never come to Brooklyn." "Uncle," she replied, "I will never tell." He told her she might stay with me, and when he had gone, I took her in my arms and told her I was a slave, and that was the reason she must never say she had seen me. I exhorted her to be a good child, to try to please the people where she was going, and that God would raise her up friends. I told her to say her prayers and remember always to pray for her poor mother, and that God would permit us to meet again. She wept, and I did not check her tears. Perhaps she would never again have the chance to pour her tears into a mother's bosom. All night she nestled in my arms, and I had no inclination to slumber. The moments were too precious to lose any of them. Once, when I thought she was asleep, I kissed her forehead softly, and she said, "I am not asleep, dear mother." Before dawn, they came to take me back to my den. I drew aside the window curtain to take a last look of my child. The moonlight shone on her face, and I bent over her, as I had done years before, that wretched night when I ran away. I hugged her close to my throbbing heart, and tears, too sad for such young eyes to shed, flowed down her cheeks as she gave her last kiss and whispered in my ear, "Mother, I will never tell." And she never did. When I got back to my den, I threw myself on the bed and wept there alone in the darkness. It seemed as if my heart would burst. When the time for Ellen's departure drew nigh, I could hear neighbors and friends saying to her, "Goodbye, Ellen. I hope your poor mother will find you out. Won't you be glad to see her?" She replied, "Yes, ma'am." And they little dreamed of the weighty secret that weighed down her young heart. She was an affectionate child, but naturally very reserved, except with those she loved, and I felt secure that my secret would be safe with her. I heard the gate close after her, with such feelings as only a slave mother can experience. During the day, my meditations were very sad. Sometimes I feared I had been very selfish not to give up all claim to her and let her go to Illinois to be adopted by Mrs. Sand's sister. It was my experience of slavery that decided me against it. I feared that circumstances might arise that would cause her to be sent back. I felt confident that I should go to New York myself, and then I should be able to watch over her and in some degree protect her. Dr. Flint's family knew nothing of the proposed arrangement till after Ellen was gone, and the news displeased them greatly. Mrs. Flint called on Mrs. Sand's sister to inquire into the matter. She expressed her opinion very freely as to the respect Mr. Sands showed for his wife and for his own character in acknowledging those young niggers. And as for sending Ellen away, she pronounced it to be just as much stealing as it would be for him to come and take a piece of furniture out of her parlor. She said her daughter was not of age to sign the bill of sale, and the children were her property, and when she became of age or was married, she could take them wherever she could lay hands on them. Miss Emily Flint, the little girl to whom I had been bequeathed, was now in her 16th year. Her mother considered it all right and honorable for her or her future husband to steal my children, but she did not understand how anybody could hold up their heads in respectable society after they had purchased their own children, as Mr. Sands had done. Dr. Flint said very little. Perhaps he thought that Benny would be less likely to be sent away if he kept quiet. One of my letters that fell into his hands was dated from Canada, and he seldom spoke of me now. This state of things enabled me to slip down into the storeroom more frequently, where I could stand upright and move my limbs more freely. Days, weeks, and months passed, and there came no news of Ellen. I sent a letter to Brooklyn, written in my grandmother's name, to inquire whether she had arrived there. Answer was returned that she had not. I wrote to her in Washington, but no notice was taken of it. There was one person there who ought to have had some sympathy with the anxiety of the child's friends at home. But the links of such relations as he had formed with me are easily broken and cast away as rubbish. Yet how protectingly and persuasively he once talked to the poor, helpless slave girl, and how entirely I trusted him. But now suspicions darkened my mind. Was my child dead, or had they deceived me and sold her? If the secret memoirs of many members of Congress should be published, curious details would be unfolded. I once saw a letter from a member of Congress to a slave who was the mother of six of his children. He wrote to request that she would send her children away from the Great House before his return, as he expected to be accompanied by friends. The woman could not read, and was obliged to employ another to read the letter. The existence of the colored children did not trouble this gentleman. It was only the fear that friends might recognize in their features a resemblance to him. At the end of 6 months, a letter came to my grandmother from Brooklyn. It was written by a young lady in the family and announced that Ellen had just arrived. It contained the following message from her. I do try to do just as you told me to, and I pray for you every night and morning. I understood that these words were meant for me, and they were balsam to my heart. The writer closed her letter by saying, Ellen is a nice little girl, and we shall like to have her with us. My cousin, Mr. Sands, has given her to me to be my little waiting maid. I shall send her to school, and I hope someday she will write to you herself. This letter perplexed and troubled me. Had my child's father merely placed her there till she was old enough to support herself? Or had he given her to his cousin as a piece of property? If the last idea was correct, his cousin might return to the South at any time and hold Ellen as a slave. I tried to put away from me the painful thought that such a foul wrong could have been done to us. I said to myself, surely there must be some justice in man. Then I remembered, with a sigh, how slavery perverted all the natural feelings of the human heart. It gave me a pang to look on my light-hearted boy. He believed himself free, and to have him brought under the yoke of slavery would be more than I could bear. How I longed to have him safely out of the reach of its power. 28. Aunt Nancy. I have mentioned my great-aunt, who was a slave in Dr. Flint's family, and who had been my refuge during the shameful persecutions I suffered from him. This aunt had been married at 20 years of age, that is, as far as slaves can marry. She had the consent of her master and mistress, and a clergyman performed the ceremony. But it was a mere form without any legal value. Her master or mistress could annul it any day they pleased. She had always slept on the floor in the entry, near Mrs. Flint's chamber door, that she might be within call. When she was married, she was told she might have the use of a small room in an outhouse. Her mother and her husband furnished it. He was a seafaring man, and was allowed to sleep there when he was at home. But on the wedding evening, the bride was ordered to her old post on the entry floor. Mrs. Flint, at that time, had no children, but she was expecting to be a mother. And if she should want a drink of water in the night, what could she do without her slave to bring it? So my aunt was compelled to lie at her door. Until one midnight, she was forced to leave to give premature birth to a child. In a fortnight, she was required to resume her place on the entry floor because Mrs. Flint's babe needed her attentions. She kept her station there through summer and winter until she had given premature birth to 6 children. And all the while she was employed as night nurse to Mrs. Flint's children. Finally, toiling all day and being deprived of rest at night, completely broke down her constitution, and Dr. Flint declared it was impossible she could ever become the mother of a living child. The fear of losing so valuable a servant by death now induced them to allow her to sleep in her little room in the outhouse, except when there was sickness in the family. She afterwards had 2 feeble babes, one of whom died in a few days, and the other in 4 weeks. I well remember her patient sorrow as she held the last dead baby in her arms. I wish it could have lived, she said. It is not the will of God that any of my children should live, but I will try to be fit to meet their little spirits in heaven. Aunt Nancy was housekeeper and waiting maid in Dr. Flint's family. Indeed, she was the factotum of the household. Nothing went on well without her. She was my mother's twin sister, and as far as was in her power, she supplied a mother's place to us orphans. I slept with her all the time I lived in my old master's house, and the bond between us was very strong. When my friends tried to discourage me from running away, she always encouraged me. When they thought I had better return and ask my master's pardon, because there was no possibility of escape, she sent me word never to yield. She said if I persevered, I might, perhaps, gain the freedom of my children, and even if I perished in doing it, that was better than to leave them to groan under the same persecutions that had blighted my own life. After I was shut up in my dark cell, she stole away, whenever she could, to bring me the news and say something cheering. How often did I kneel down to listen to her words of consolation whispered through a crack. I am old and have not long to live, she used to say, and I could die happy if I could only see you and the children free.
You must pray to God, Linda, as I do for you, that he will lead you out of this darkness.
I would beg her not to worry herself on my account, that there was an end of all suffering sooner or later, and that whether I lived in chains or in freedom, I should always remember her as the good friend who had been the comfort of my life. A word from her always strengthened me, and not me only. The whole family relied upon her judgment and were guided by her advice. I had been in my cell 6 years when my grandmother was summoned to the bedside of this, her last remaining daughter. She was very ill, and they said she would die. Grandmother had not entered Dr. Flint's house for several years. They had treated her cruelly, but she thought nothing of that now. She was grateful for permission to watch by the deathbed of her child. They had always been devoted to each other, and now they sat looking into each other's eyes, longing to speak of the secret that had weighed so much on the hearts of both. My aunt had been stricken with paralysis. She lived but 2 days, and the last day she was speechless. Before she lost the power of utterance, she told her mother not to grieve if she could not speak to her, that she would try to hold up her hand to let her know that all was well with her. Even the hard-hearted doctor was a little softened when he saw the dying woman try to smile on the aged mother who was kneeling by her side. His eyes moistened for a moment as he said she had always been a faithful servant and they should never be able to supply her place. Mrs. Flint took to her bed, quite overcome by the shock. While my grandmother sat alone with the dead, the doctor came in, leading his youngest son, who had always been a great pet with Aunt Nancy, and was much attached to her. "Martha," said he, "Aunt Nancy loved this child, and when he comes where you are, I hope you will be kind to him for her sake." She replied, "Your wife was my foster child, Dr. Flint, the foster sister of my poor Nancy. And you little know me if you think I can feel anything but goodwill for her children. I wish the past could be forgotten and that we might never think of it," said he, "and that Linda would come to supply her aunt's place. She would be worth more to us than all the money that could be paid for her. I wish it for your sake also, Martha. Now that Nancy is taken away from you, she would be a great comfort to your old age." He knew he was touching a tender chord. Almost choking with grief, my grandmother replied, "It was not I that drove Linda away. My grandchildren are gone, and of my 9 children, only one is left. God help me." To me, the death of this kind relative was an inexpressible sorrow. I knew that she had been slowly murdered, and I felt that my troubles had helped to finish the work. After I heard of her illness, I listened constantly to hear what news was brought from the great house, and the thought that I could not go to her made me utterly miserable. At last, as Uncle Philip came into the house, I heard someone inquire, "How is she?" And he answered, "She is dead." My little cell seemed whirling round, and I knew nothing more till I opened my eyes and found Uncle Philip bending over me. I had no need to ask any questions. He whispered, "Linda, she died happy." I could not weep. My fixed gaze troubled him. "Don't look so," he said. "Don't add to my poor mother's trouble. Remember how much she has to bear, and that we ought to do all we can to comfort her." Ah, yes, that blessed old grandmother, who for 73 years had borne the pelting storms of a slave mother's life. She did indeed need consolation. Mrs. Flint had rendered her poor foster sister childless, apparently without any compunction, and with cruel selfishness had ruined her health by years of incessant, unrequited toil and broken rest. But now she became very sentimental. I suppose she thought it would be a beautiful illustration of the attachment existing between slaveholder and slave, if the body of her old, worn-out servant was buried at her feet. She sent for the clergyman and asked if he had any objection to burying Aunt Nancy in the doctor's family burial place. No colored person had ever been allowed interment in the white people's burying ground, and the minister knew that all the deceased of your family reposed together in the old graveyard of the slaves. He therefore replied, I have no objection to complying with your wish, but perhaps Aunt Nancy's mother may have some choice as to where her remains shall be deposited. It had never occurred to Mrs. Flint that slaves could have any feelings. When my grandmother was consulted, she at once said she wanted Nancy to lie with all the rest of her family and where her own old body would be buried. Mrs. Flint graciously complied with her wish, though she said it was painful to her to have Nancy buried away from her. She might have added with touching pathos, "I was so long used to sleep with her lying near me on the entry floor." My Uncle Philip asked permission to bury his sister at his own expense, and slaveholders are always ready to grant such favors to slaves and their relatives. The arrangements were very plain, but perfectly respectable. She was buried on the Sabbath, and Mrs. Flint's minister read the funeral service. There was a large concourse of colored people, bond and free, and a few white persons who had always been friendly to our family. Dr. Flint's carriage was in the procession, and when the body was deposited in its humble resting place, the mistress dropped a tear and returned to her carriage, probably thinking she had performed her duty nobly. It was talked of by the slaves as a mighty grand funeral. Northern travelers, passing through the place, might have described this tribute of respect to the humble dead as a beautiful feature in the patriarchal institution, a touching proof of the attachment between slaveholders and their servants. And tender-hearted Mrs. Flint would have confirmed this impression with handkerchief at her eyes. We could have told them a different story. We could have given them a chapter of wrongs and sufferings that would have touched their hearts, if they had any hearts, to feel for the colored people. We could have told them how the poor old slave mother had toiled year after year to earn $800 to buy her son Philip's right to his own earnings, and how that same Philip paid the expenses of the funeral, which they regarded as doing so much credit to the master. We could also have told them of a poor blighted young creature shut up in a living grave for years to avoid the tortures that would be inflicted on her if she ventured to come out and look on the face of her departed friend. All this, and much more, I thought of as I sat at my loophole, waiting for the family to return from the grave, sometimes weeping, sometimes falling asleep, dreaming strange dreams of the dead and the living. It was sad to witness the grief of my bereaved grandmother. She had always been strong to bear, and now, as ever, religious faith supported her. But her dark life had become still darker, and age and trouble were leaving deep traces on her withered face. She had four places to knock for me to come to the trap door, and each place had a different meaning. She now came oftener than she had done, and talked to me of her dead daughter, while tears trickled slowly down her furrowed cheeks. I said all I could to comfort her, but it was a sad reflection that instead of being able to help her, I was a constant source of anxiety and trouble. The poor old back was fitted to its burden. It bent under it, but did not break. 29. Preparations for Escape. I hardly expect that the reader will credit me when I affirm that I lived in that little dismal hole, almost deprived of light and air, and with no space to move my limbs, for nearly 7 years. But it is a fact, and to me a sad one, even now, for my body still suffers from the effects of that long imprisonment, to say nothing of my soul. Members of my family, now living in New York and Boston, can testify to the truth of what I say. Countless were the nights that I sat late at the little loophole, scarcely large enough to give me a glimpse of one twinkling star. There, heard the patrols and slave hunters conferring together about the capture of runaways, well knowing how rejoiced they would be to catch me. Season after season, year after year, I peeped at my children's faces and heard their sweet voices, with a heart yearning all the while to say, "Your mother is here." Sometimes it appeared to me as if ages had rolled away since I entered upon that gloomy, monotonous existence. At times, I was stupefied and listless. At other times, I became very impatient to know when these dark years would end and I should again be allowed to feel the sunshine and breathe the pure air. After Ellen left us, this feeling increased. Mr. Sands had agreed that Benny might go to the north whenever his Uncle Philip could go with him. And I was anxious to be there also, to watch over my children and protect them so far as I was able. Moreover, I was likely to be drowned out of my den if I remained much longer, for the slight roof was getting badly out of repair, and Uncle Philip was afraid to remove the shingles, lest someone should get a glimpse of me. When storms occurred in the night, they spread mats and bits of carpet, which in the morning appeared to have been laid out to dry, but to cover the roof in the daytime might have attracted attention. Consequently, my clothes and bedding were often drenched, a process by which the pains and aches in my cramped and stiffened limbs were greatly increased. I revolved various plans of escape in my mind, which I sometimes imparted to my grandmother when she came to whisper with me at the trap door. The kind-hearted old woman had an intense sympathy for runaways. She had known too much of the cruelties inflicted on those who were captured. Her memory always flew back at once to the sufferings of her bright and handsome son, Benjamin, the youngest and dearest of her flock. So whenever I alluded to the subject, she would groan out, "Oh, don't think of it, child. You'll break my heart." I had no good old Aunt Nancy now to encourage me, but my brother William and my children were continually beckoning me to the north. And now I must go back a few months in my story. I have stated that the 1st of January was the time for selling slaves or leasing them out to new masters. If time were counted by heartthrobs, the poor slaves might reckon years of suffering during that festival so joyous to the free. On the New Year's Day preceding my aunt's death, one of my friends, named Fanny, was to be sold at auction to pay her master's debts. My thoughts were with her during all the day, and at night I anxiously inquired what had been her fate. I was told that she had been sold to one master, and her four little girls to another master, far distant, that she had escaped from her purchaser and was not to be found. Her mother was the old Aggie I have spoken of. She lived in a small tenement belonging to my grandmother, and built on the same lot with her own house. Her dwelling was searched and watched, and that brought the patrols so near me that I was obliged to keep very close in my den. The hunters were somehow eluded, and not long afterwards Benny accidentally caught sight of Fanny in her mother's hut. He told his grandmother, who charged him never to speak of it, explaining to him the frightful consequences, and he never betrayed the trust. Aggie little dreamed that my grandmother knew where her daughter was concealed, and that the stooping form of her old neighbor was bending under a similar burden of anxiety and fear. But these dangerous secrets deepened the sympathy between the two old persecuted mothers. My friend Fanny and I remained many weeks hidden within call of each other, but she was unconscious of the fact. I longed to have her share my den, which seemed a more secure retreat than her own. But I had brought so much trouble on my grandmother that it seemed wrong to ask her to incur greater risks. My restlessness increased. I had lived too long in bodily pain and anguish of spirit. Always I was in dread that by some accident or some contrivance, slavery would succeed in snatching my children from me. This thought drove me nearly frantic, and I determined to steer for the North Star at all hazards. At this crisis, Providence opened an unexpected way for me to escape. My friend Peter came one evening and asked to speak with me. "Your day has come, Linda," said he. "I have found a chance for you to go to the Free States. You have a fortnight to decide." The news seemed too good to be true, but Peter explained his arrangements and told me all that was necessary was for me to say I would go. I was going to answer him with a joyful yes, when the thought of Benny came to my mind. I told him the temptation was exceedingly strong, but I was terribly afraid of Dr. Flint's alleged power over my child, and that I could not go and leave him behind. Peter remonstrated earnestly. He said such a good chance might never occur again, that Benny was free and could be sent to me, and that for the sake of my children's welfare, I ought not to hesitate a moment. I told him I would consult with Uncle Philip. My uncle rejoiced in the plan and bade me go by all means. He promised, if his life was spared, that he would either bring or send my son to me as soon as I reached a place of safety. I resolved to go, but thought nothing had better be said to my grandmother till very near the time of departure. but my uncle thought she would feel it more keenly if I left here so suddenly. "I will reason with her," said he, "and convince her how necessary it is, not only for your sake, but for hers also. You cannot be blind to the fact that she is sinking under her burdens." I was not blind to it. I knew that my concealment was an ever-present source of anxiety, and that the older she grew, the more nervously fearful she was of discovery. My uncle talked with her, and finally succeeded in persuading her that it was absolutely necessary for me to seize the chance so unexpectedly offered. The anticipation of being a free woman proved almost too much for my weak frame. The excitement stimulated me and at the same time bewildered me. I made busy preparations for my journey and for my son to follow me. I resolved to have an interview with him before I went, that I might give him cautions and advice and tell him how anxiously I should be waiting for him at the north. Grandmother stole up to me as often as possible to whisper words of counsel. She insisted upon writing to Dr. Flint as soon as I arrived in the Free States and asking him to sell me to her. She said she would sacrifice her house and all she had in the world for the sake of having me safe with my children in any part of the world. If she could only live to know that, she could die in peace. I promised the dear old faithful friend that I would write to her as soon as I arrived and put the letter in a safe way to reach her. But in my own mind, I resolved that not another cent of her hard earnings should be spent to pay rapacious slaveholders for what they called their property. And even if I had not been unwilling to buy what I had already a right to possess, common humanity would have prevented me from accepting the generous offer, at the expense of turning my aged relative out of house and home when she was trembling on the brink of the grave. I was to escape in a vessel, but I forbear to mention any further particulars. I was in readiness, but the vessel was unexpectedly detained several days. Meanwhile, news came to town of a most horrible murder committed on a fugitive slave named James. Charity, the mother of this unfortunate young man, had been an old acquaintance of ours. I have told the shocking particulars of his death in my description of some of the neighboring slaveholders. My grandmother, always nervously sensitive about runaways, was terribly frightened. She felt sure that a similar fate awaited me if I did not desist from my enterprise. She sobbed and groaned and entreated me not to go. Her excessive fear was somewhat contagious, and my heart was not proof against her extreme agony. I was grievously disappointed, but I promised to relinquish my project. When my friend Peter was apprised of this, he was both disappointed and vexed. He said that judging from our past experience, it would be a long time before I had such another chance to throw away. I told him it need not be thrown away, that I had a friend concealed nearby who would be glad enough to take the place that had been provided for me. I told him about poor Fanny and the kind-hearted, noble fellow who never turned his back upon anybody in distress, white or black, expressed his readiness to help her. Aggie was much surprised when she found that we knew her secret. She was rejoiced to hear of such a chance for Fanny, and arrangements were made for her to go on board the vessel the next night. They both supposed that I had long been at the North, therefore my name was not mentioned in the transaction. Fanny was carried on board at the appointed time and stowed away in a very small cabin. This accommodation had been purchased at a price that would pay for a voyage to England. But when one proposes to go to fine old England, they stop to calculate whether they can afford the cost of the pleasure. While in making a bargain to escape from slavery, the trembling victim is ready to say, "Take all I have, only don't betray me." The next morning I peeped through my loophole and saw that it was dark and cloudy. At night, I received news that the wind was ahead and the vessel had not sailed. I was exceedingly anxious about Fanny, and Peter, too, who was running a tremendous risk at my instigation. Next day, the wind and weather remained the same. Poor Fanny had been half dead with fright when they carried her on board, and I could readily imagine how she must be suffering now. Grandmother came often to my den to say how thankful she was I did not go. On the third morning, she rapped for me to come down to the storeroom. The poor old sufferer was breaking down under her weight of trouble. She was easily flurried now. I found her in a nervous, excited state, but I was not aware that she had forgotten to lock the door behind her, as usual. She was exceedingly worried about the detention of the vessel. She was afraid all would be discovered, and then Fanny and Peter and I would all be tortured to death, and Philip would be utterly ruined, and her house would be torn down.